Okay. Good morning, everybody. We are here today. Our first case is State versus NKB. Start with the appearances. Good morning. I have 25 minutes, 30 minutes, and 5 minutes for rebuttal. Whenever you're ready.
Good morning. Thank you, Chief Justice, and may it please the court. A defendant committed for trial competency restoration may present a danger to her or to others at the institution charged with her care. This case is an example of that. While committed at Mendota, Naomi repeatedly assaulted staff and other patients and refused to take potentially life-saving medication for a serious thyroid condition. The dispute between the parties today is whether, in situations like this, the government can return to the committing court to get an involuntary medication order to address dangerousness at the institution, or whether the government must go out and obtain a second mental health commitment under Chapter 51 in order to get that order. The state's position is that a second mental health commitment is not necessary. And I want to jump into how I think the statute that the state is relying on works, because I realize the parties are talking past each other a little bit in the briefing. Individuals in Wisconsin can find themselves in a mental health commitment for a variety of reasons. It can be to help to restore them to trial competency. It can be because they're sexually violent persons under 980. It can be because they've been found NGI. It can be because they've been found they're mentally ill, a proper subject for treatment, and dangerous under 5120. So we have all these various mental health commitments in Wisconsin. And once an individual is placed into one of those mental health commitments, the individual, along with the committing court, becomes connected to 5161. And that is the statute that governs patients' rights under the Mental Health Code. So I think it might be helpful to think of 5161 as this hub of a wheel, and we have these spokes coming out from the hub that reach all these various mental health commitments. And it is through this connection to the hub, 5161, that these various committing courts have authority to order involuntary medication to address a need in an institutional setting. And that's where we get into 5161-1G3. I may just shortchange it and say 1G3. It's a mouthful. And I view that as having two procedural paths to medication in that statute. I think that there is a court route to get medication, and then I think there is a non-court route for true emergency situations. And let me start with the court route, because that is the route that the government chose in this case. And we find that in the first clause of the statute, where we have explicit court authorization language in the statute. It allows an interested party to move the committing court for a medication order, saying that the person needs medication and is not competent to refuse it. Now, under that path, under that court authorization path, the defendant gets notice of the motion. There is a hearing held within 10 days. The defendant has a right to counsel at the hearing. The defendant has a right to cross-examine and call witnesses at this hearing. And under that path, we get a decision on a decision on medication by a neutral arbiter. And the state's position is, logically, a need for medication contemplated under that first route, under the court authorization route, could be because the person could seriously harm themselves or others if they're left unmedicated. And I think the state's reading of a need in that context being to address a dangerous situation in the institutional setting is confirmed by this court's decision in Anthony DB. Very similar situation where the government came in a 980 commitment and said, we need a medication order because this person is dangerous to himself and others in the institutional setting. And this court said, yes, that is a type of need where a court could order involuntary medication under that first clause. Now, the second clause of the statute, I think, could be read a few different ways, but I agree with my friend on the other side that the best reading of that second clause of the statute, where we have the explicit dangerousness language, would be to view it as calling for, I'm going to refer to it as a no time to wait clause. I think it calls for a true emergency situation in a setting like Mendota, where the treatment decision can be made by staff at Mendota or these various institutions with no court involvement whatsoever. And I do think this court in Jones, in looking at that language, did read the statute that way to say, this is not a situation where you have to involve the court. The people on the ground can make the treatment decision themselves. So we view 5161 as having both of these routes to medication, and ultimately the government in this case chose that first route. And I wanna explain why I think that was a prudent decision. I think with the court authorization route, we are giving the defendant the due process protections that are important in this context. Obviously, we're dealing with a significant liberty interest when we're medicating someone. So I think the government's decision to not just make the treatment decision on its own and instead involve a court and get a neutral arbiter to decide the issue was a prudent approach in this case. And that is what we were asking for this court to affirm.
So where do you see in that first section any mention of dangerousness, the first part of this? I mean, you make a great argument for a legislature of why they should do something. I mean, it makes perfect sense what you're saying, that dangerousness would be a reason that one might want to or need to order medication. And we've got 51. When you talk about those spokes, that's the spoke of dangerousness. So where do you see it? I mean, I thought you were relying on the second piece. It was unclear from the briefing which piece, but in the first part of that, it talks about the individual is not competent to refuse medication or treatment. Where does it say anything about dangerousness?
So if you continue on, obviously we read statutes as the full context of the statute. It talks about under that first court authorization route, it talks about if there is a report attached to a motion under that procedure, the report has to be signed by a licensed physician that says that the individual needs medication and is not competent to refuse it. So there definitely has to be a need for medication. And my argument is, I think a need for medication logically, when we're talking about an institutional setting, logically could be for dangerousness. And I think, as we've argued in the brief, and I apologize if I wasn't clear, I think the second clause where we see that explicit dangerousness language just goes to confirm that the type of need for medication that we would be talking about is something that a court could order under that first clause.
Isn't it the opposite? Doesn't it go to confirm that if the legislature wanted to talk about dangerousness, it certainly knows how, and it context of a need for it in a certain situation, and it did not do so in the first part of that clause when it talks about the court and the hearing and the process, and it says nothing about dangerous.
I disagree. I think you have to read the language of the statute as a whole. I can't think of what other need. I mean, to me, the clearest need that we might have for medication contemplated under that first clause would be because a person is dangerous in an
institution. Isn't it to treat them to competency, which is exactly what we're doing here? That they're
different interests. The reason for the commitment is trial competency restoration.
Right.
But once a person is in one of our mental health institutions, it is important that the government have an opportunity to take care of that patient safely. And so this is how we read the statute, is giving these committing courts the authority to address the situation. The committing court is the court responsible for putting this individual in the commitment. And from the state's perspective, it makes the most sense in this situation that we would just allow the committing court, the court that put this person here, who's overseeing the commitment, to be the court to respond to this type of situation. And under the state's reading, it is a more efficient approach because under the state—
Counsel, I have a question about what you mean by dangerousness here, because there are a lot of different definitions of dangerousness throughout the statutes. 5120 has several. The statute we're looking at right now has the definition of dangerousness in terms of preventing serious injury to other people or the person. Are you importing that particular definition of dangerousness into the preceding clause?
Yes. I'm comfortable for today's purposes using a threat of serious physical harm to self or others as the standard for dangerousness. And I do want to, I think it's really important to understand that the definitions of dangerousness that my friend on the other side prefers here in 5120, those are standards that are set forth for getting a mental health commitment in the first place. And so, and my understanding of 51 is you still have to go through 5161(1)(G)(3) once you get a person committed under Chapter 51. We are still going to come back to the same statute that I'm talking about when we want to get an involuntary medication order. So in that regard, we really view my friend on this other side's argument as asking the state to take a detour for no good reason, because we are going to be ending up right back at the same statute.
Well, counsel, if you believe that the standard of dangerousness here is the one in that second clause, and you believe that the doctors don't need a court order to invoke that, then what was the purpose in going back to the court to get that court order? And where's this statutory authority for the circuit court to enter the order for involuntary medications? I'm just not following your parsing of the statutory.
So the standard of threat of serious physical harm to self or others, I think that can cover both an emergency situation and a non-emergency situation. I think an emergency situation, let me give the example of somebody that has sepsis in the institution. That is a true emergency situation where we don't have time to wait for 10 days to go back into court and have a hearing. A non-emergency—
Where in that part of the statute does it mention an emergency? Why are you construing that provision to require only a brief period of medication for some emergent situation?
I'm not saying it is a brief period of medication, but what I am saying is the way the statute is written is that you clearly have this court procedure on the one hand, and then you have this or unless language, which to me like signifies a different type of situation where you don't have to go into court because. And again, this court's decision in Jones, this court did interpret that language as calling for emergency situations in a hospital setting.
And you think there was not an emergency here?
I think, I can't speak for DHS, but I think DHS felt that they had time to go to court. And I'm going to reiterate, I think we should be encouraging that route when the government can, because it affords the defendant due process and we get a decision by a neutral arbiter on dangerousness. And just to further up on my point, Justice Crawford, about there's a difference between both, I think, emergency and non-emergency situations can fit that dangerousness standard. I think an example of a non-emergency situation is what we had here with Naomi's serious thyroid condition, right? DHS recognized she had hypothyroidism. They were concerned that this was going to come to a head and potentially cause significant damage to her organs, possibly a life-threatening situation. I think it was smart for DHS to try to get ahead of it. They felt they could go to court and had the time to do that. I don't think we want to be saying DHS should wait until it's a life-threatening situation and then they just make the medication decision on their own.
I just want to follow up on that because I guess I'm still struggling to discern your answer to Justice Crawford's question about the statutory authority for the court to act. I mean, your argument seems to be it makes sense, it's reasonable, it's convenient, we should encourage it, but I'm struggling to understand the statutory authority for the court to issue an order. And as we're reviewing an order that needs to have, I mean, courts don't just make orders because it would be efficient or a good idea, they have to have some legal authority for doing so. So to me, that's what I'm trying to figure out, what the statutory authority for the court order is.
So I think there is explicit court authorization language in the first clause of the statute that contemplates that someone can come into court and the court can order involuntary medication where a patient needs it and is not competent to refuse it. So that is where we see the express language authorizing a court to order an involuntary medication order. And that's exactly what happened in Anthony DB. And this court said that the lower court was authorized by that first clause to order involuntary medication to address dangerousness at an institution. So again, the first clause allows for a court procedure and allows a court to issue an order for medication. And where I'm getting dangerousness from is by recognizing the language in the statute that says the patient, there needs to be a need for medication. It's not as if the government is just coming in and saying, this person's incompetent to refuse medication. And while they don't have a need for it, we want to medicate them.
Well, counsel, one of NKB's arguments is that the provision in 971.14, I think it is, that authorizes the court to order involuntary medication for a person who's not competent to refuse to restore competency sort of occupies the field on that topic, and that because it's a more specific provision that is directed at the competency restoration process, that that's the only authorization to order medications based on a person's lack of competence to refuse medications. So I'd like you to talk about, to the extent you believe there is no conflict in the statutes, or that that more specific provision shouldn't be the one that applies.
Sure. Thank you. I view the language in 9714, 3DM and 4B, I believe, as a limited version of the not competent to refuse exception we see in 5161.1G3. What do I mean by that? I think it's a limited version because I think the only need for medication contemplated under 97114 is the need for medication to restore trial competency. I agree. I do think it is a narrower statute. It's clearly a narrower statute than 5161.1G3. And this court in Fitzgerald has interpreted that language as solely governing trial competency restoration. So that's more narrow. We get to 5161.1G3. It's obviously a broader statute. It covers more than people that are just committed under 9714. And I think it encompasses a broader range of needs for medication. And so what's important to keep in mind here is that 5161 and 97114 are closely related statutes. That is not disputed in this case. And when we have closely related statutes, we're supposed to be interpreting them as one. They're supposed to work together unless there is an irreconcilable conflict. And to me, the easiest way for me to understand this is to take a step back and ask, if this court were to hold that a committing court under 97114 has the authority to order involuntary medication for dangerousness under 5161, what does that conflict with in 97114? And no one has pointed out a conflict with those two provisions.
Would involuntarily administering medication to address dangerousness always assist in restoring someone to competency?
Not necessarily, but again, I think it's really important to separate out these overriding governmental the reason why we have the commitment is for trial competency restoration, but we're not seeking a medication order for that purpose. And I'll remind the court that in Sell, the U.S. Supreme Court case that we'll be getting into a bit on Monday, the court made very clear that if lower courts have the authority to order involuntary medication for dangerousness, they should be taking that route over going the Sell route, which governs involuntary medication to restore competency. So if this court does agree with the state's reading of the statute, I do think it's important for this opinion to make clear that in this context, if you have a situation where we have someone dangerous in an institution, that is supposed to be the first thing the circuit court is asking the government. Are you seeking a medication order to address dangerousness before even getting into the cell factors? Why the U.S. Supreme Court said, well, we view dangerousness as a more objective and manageable inquiry than the cell factors, which are a bit more complicated.
I just want to bring you back to Anthony DB for a moment. I think we've all read it. We've reread it. But doesn't it hold right up front, quote, our conclusions in this case are limited to individuals committed pursuant to Chapter 980 and who also suffer from a chronic mental illness such as schizophrenia. We don't have a 980 commitment here. How do you harmonize that?
Yeah, I think I know that language exists. I still think Anthony DB is very instructive in telling us when 5161.1G3 applies and how did this court decide that it applied in that case. It looked to 5161 and how the statute defines patient. So I think it's instructive in telling us when the statute applies. And I think it's also instructive in telling us what the statute authorizes when it does apply. And again, the request in that case was for involuntary medication to address dangerousness at an institution. And this court said, using that first clause in the statute that I was talking about, that a medication order for dangerousness is contemplated within the meaning of that first clause.
Go ahead. Want to finish?
Please.
I want to go back to your spokes because I like it.
Okay. I can't take credit for that.
I like it a lot, but it frames my question. If we think about it as spokes and we think about 51 as being this hub, the spoke of 980 from Anthony DB has a finding of dangerousness inherent in the commitment. The spoke of 5120 is a finding of dangerousness inherent in the commitment. We are not under either of those. We are under the spoke of 971, which has no finding of dangerousness. So why would you read this provision to import a dangerousness finding when 971 does not contemplate that in the same way that those other spokes, you've already made that determination?
So just to clarify with the spokes, the dangerousness finding is the reason why you get a commitment for 5120, for example.
Correct.
Okay. But you still would have to go to court and get an involuntary medication order and show that the patient needs it because they're dangerous.
Well,
so it's not as if you get a 5120 commitment and automatically you get an involuntary medication order. So these are different. I think it's important to think of.
No, that's true. But 5120 includes that dangerousness finding in the order for involuntary commitment.
But you still have to go to court and show the court there is a need for this individual to have medication
right,
in the institution.
Right. No, I get that. But we're in 971 doesn't have that in and of itself. So you're trying to import something from this provision to do that.
5161 applies to people committed under 9714 by its plain terms.
Right. Can we start with the beginning of 5161? Sure. It says they have the right to exercise informed consent. So, and then it gives an exception. So this is not the section such as in 5120 that talks about when a court can involuntarily medicate someone.
Not true. It is. 5161, 1G3, look at Melanie L., Matter of CS. These are both cases that dealt with Chapter 51s and involuntary medication orders under Chapter 51, and they go through 5161, 1G3.
Right, in conjunction with 5120, which sets forth the standards for how you
That's
get
That's how you
that
get
order.
The commitment.
Right, and also for how you get the order as well for involuntary medication.
Yes, but 5161 tells us 97114 can go through 5161 1G3 for a medication order. It's by virtue of the connection to the hub.
Yes, I get it. And again, where's the dangerousness piece?
Okay, I'll walk through it again. No. So I
get how you view it.
We're conflating the reason for the commitment, the mental health commitment, with the reason for the medication order. They're different things.
Yes, I know. And okay. The reason you can get a medication order by the court under this subsection, sub 3, is for being not competent to refuse. It doesn't say anything about a court and dangerousness here.
The government is going to have to say that there is a need for medication, not just that the person is incompetent to refuse. We don't walk into court and say, this person doesn't need medication, but they're not competent to refuse it, so we want to admit it.
So anytime there's a need for medication, it's automatically could be dangerousness.
No, I don't think it's automatically going to be dangerousness, but I think that is one of the needs contemplated under the statute. And when someone is committed under 5120 and the government comes in and says, we've got a need for medication, it's going to be because the person needs medication because they're dangerous. And that 5161 1G3 is what authorizes that order. So I want to be really clear. I really think we have to step back and think about this, because we're always going to end up at the same place. We're always going to end up back at the statute. And what my friend on the other side's argument means is we have to, instead of just going to the committing court and getting a hearing within 10 days, we have to involve a new judge. We have to potentially be in a different county. We have to involve a new player. A corporation counsel is the one that would initiate the Chapter 51. I'm not convinced that that would happen when we already have a mental health commitment in place. And we'd have to have these additional proceedings all to end up at the same place, which is 5161 1G3.
But counsel, the way I understand your interpretation of the statutes is that the court can order involuntary medications upon a finding that the person is not competent to refuse medications and presents a risk of serious injury to someone. But then that second clause, the one that actually talks about that risk of serious injury, authorizes the doctors to involuntarily medicate without any finding that the person is not competent to refuse medications. So why would we be pairing those two thresholds, those two difficult requirements to meet when the court is ordering it, but when the doctors are pursuing involuntary medication for dangerousness, they don't have to make any finding that they can overcome the person's competent refusal, but apparently the judge can't do that? Does that make sense?
I have thought about that. And I think my best answer is just, I think in the true emergency situation, we just don't have time to get into whether the person is competent to refuse medication or not. That is why we're saying the medical staff can just make the decision. But I think I'm trying to adhere to the plain language of the statute. And so if we go the court authorization route, which we do think contemplates an order for dangerousness, then I'm fine saying that we also have to establish that the individual is not competent to refuse medication.
So the court could not order medication, involuntary medication for dangerousness, if the court finds the person is competent to refuse.
If we go under that first route, yes, I think. You know, there's an interesting question of whether you could read that second clause as providing standalone authority for the government to go into court and just say, this person is dangerous. We don't have to establish a not competent.
So do you agree in that setting, the only option is to get a Chapter 51 petition started?
I'm not sure I understand.
If the court is asked to order involuntary medications based on a finding of dangerousness, but the court finds the person is competent to refuse medications, the government's only option at that point to medicate the person would be to file a Chapter 51 petition.
Unless it was a true emergency situation. Yes. Unless there are other questions. Thank you.
Can you just make sure that you raise the microphone? Just make sure it's in a good place. We've been having some sound issues, and I want to make sure everyone can hear you.
Okay, I'll try to be loud. I'm soft.
You can also raise the podium if it's more comfortable. Thank you.
You're welcome. Good morning, and may it please the court. Again, my name is Timothy Drua, and I'm representing NKB, whom I'll be referring to as Naomi. My plan is to go through a short overview before I get into the specifics. This case calls for a simple, plain language reading of Wisconsin's comprehensive statutory framework to administer involuntary medications. This framework strikes a careful balance between the state's interest in securing institutional safety and an individual's fundamental right to be free from unwanted medical treatment. The government in this case is seeking to destroy this balance at the peril of individuals like Naomi. There's no doubt that Naomi was in a position that she needed help. The government could have acted quickly to provide her that help by seeking a Chapter 5120 commitment. Had it done so, it could have quickly assuaged any concern of dangerousness, it could have quickly focused on her long-term care, and it could have quickly assessed whether she was competent to refuse medications. But it didn't do so. Instead, the government inflamed a mental health crisis by choosing to focus solely on charging her with a crime, which caused her to be imprisoned for weeks without bail, and worse, without treatment.
You may be right that there is a crisis and there are big problems with people who are mentally ill ending up in criminal proceedings. I don't necessarily disagree with that one single bit. But it is the government's call as to whether they're going to charge them with a crime. Are you saying the government shouldn't be charging them with a crime? They need to proceed under Chapter 51 and that you're asking for wholesale public policy changes in that regard?
Absolutely not. The government has the authority to charge people with crimes. Prosecutors have that discretion and they should be given that discretion to exercise as they see fit. But that does not mean they should be able to ignore the other statutory authority than to seek the proper mental health commitment.
So when someone's charged with a crime, but they're not competent to proceed, there are a number of things that happen, but naturally the person under certain circumstances will be put in a situation where the court's trying to balance a lot of things, including victim rights and other things, and have the person get back to competent status, which is very different than the end goal of Chapter 51, right? I mean, sometimes they're the same, but competency to stand trial in a criminal setting is very different than the end goal of people who are subject to commitment in Chapter 51. We agree on
yes, that. Yes, it's treatment focused more.
So when the court has this limited period of time to attempt to get someone back to competency status, your argument really is their tools are limited. You can't really involuntarily medicate this person very easily without going through Chapter 51 and starting over.
No, they could. This court in Fitzgerald held that the court is able to review whether the person is not competent to refuse, but then the court has to assess the self factors. And that's the easy way for the criminal court to issue an involuntary medication order.
So your position is the only way the statute stays constitutional is if the self factors are applied. There's no reading of Chapter 51, 61 together with 971, and dangerousness matters not. The person could be very dangerous to their cellmate, to the other people in prison, to the people that work there or jail, to the staff that work there, to the people who are trying to administer things to them. And the courts have to say, oh, we can't do anything about that. They can be very dangerous to everyone there, even though they're confined and can't really get out and don't have the keys to the jailhouse door. And the jail just has to live with that. And nope. The people have to live with that. And this person will be maybe repeatedly sedated instead of treated, maybe held in a different kind of capacity. And that's what you're asking this court to say. No dangerousness can apply.
I think it's more specific. As for the criminal court issuing a medication order, then dangerousness does not give them the authority to issue the order. But that does not leave the facility without any options. The facility can use its emergency authority right. to medicate the person.
And right. then what's that mean? Sedate them, really, right?
They can overcome the right to refuse. That's stated in the statutes and also in the administrative rules that they don't have a right to refuse medications, and those are psychotropic medications, okay. which so may...
What you're saying, I'm just trying to make sure it's not a be careful what you ask for in a very real way. So what you're saying is the jail, without any court approval, without any due process, can, under your argument, go ahead and medicate these people with zero court order from a court and zero supervision during a competency commitment, not Chapter 51.
Yes, absolutely. Medical professionals such as psychiatrists engage in an important role as public agents to effectuate the public's interest in maintaining institutional
order. So just to the-
If that's, one no, final thing. Yeah. If that's the case, why do we bother with this at all? I mean, the courts never ever have to do anything with respect to medication and whether it should or shouldn't be administered, because under your argument, the jail can do whatever they want with zero supervision of the court.
Not-
If the person's dangerous.
No, because the- emergency situation is momentary. So the doctors are allowed to overcome the right to refuse momentarily, but that justification that intrudes upon the person's right to refuse is just as fast acting to turn on as it is to turn off. And we trust our physicians will operate within those ethical rules to only do it in the momentary need of an emergency. A court order, however, lasts longer past the emergency, past the need to prevent serious physical harm physical harm. And that's where there's a difference between the emergency situation and a court order that's usually meant more for a treatment purpose.
Well, counsel, the statute just says, it uses the term necessary, medication or treatment necessary to prevent serious physical harm. And in Naomi's case, I believe that what the doctors wanted to do, and they went to court, but let's posit that they were doing it under this provision. They wanted to inject her with the psychotropic drugs that were going to address her mental health disorder in order to, which is what they believed was necessary for her to stop hurting people. Do you think that was something they could or could not do under that provision?
to seek a court order, the court did not have authority to issue.
No, I'm not talking about that. I'm saying that if the doctors had decided to act independently under that provision to dose Naomi with these psychotropic medications that they believed were necessary to address her harmful behavior, do you think they could have opted to act under that provision? And if not, why not?
Not in Naomi's case. As it says, it's a situation that you need medication to prevent. And what the court or the hospital actually did, first they asked for a medication order because she was not competent to refuse. Then it asked for a medication order claiming she was dangerous. And the testimony really came down to these alleged acts that have occurred. The doctor reported what he reviewed in the reports about these prior actions. But one of the specific things I wanted to mention is the thyroid issue was not part of the medication order.
In the what issue?
The thyroid, her thyroid concerns.
Right.
Specifically, the doctor testified that the medication order would not be to give her those medication orders. So that is the testimony that the doctor.
Well, and that's not the medication I was asking you about. I was asking you about the psychotropic medication.
Right.
That they were using to address her harmful behavior.
Yeah.
Could they not have opted to pursue that under that, unless the situation exists, provision?
If there was.
It certainly seemed like an emergency situation to me. She's hurting people. She's having to be kept locked up in a cell-like room with nothing in it.
If they,
why is that not an emergency as you see it under that provision?
If they believed it was an actual emergency, then the physicians would be able to operate under that clause. But again, that's momentary. And if there's lasting—
Where does the statute say it's momentary? And what do you mean by that exactly?
So when I'm talking about momentary, we look at the reasons for issuing the emergency order. And when we look at cases like Jones, it states it's always in an emergency when there's a concern for serious harm to others. Those decisions are professionally determined to meet the immediate need. And this implied consent concept is a standard exception to the informed consent doctrine. So it's an immediate need that needs to be addressed by the doctors. And that's in their administrative rules as well. It states specifically in the administrative rules that if there is an emergency, they do not have the right to refuse. So that word emergency that's used in the administrative code and other decisions contemplates a momentary need that justifies the intrusion into the person's right to refuse.
So you're importing that language into the statute from the administrative rule?
No, but I think it does support the reason it's in 5161. 5161, I think it's important to note, is not meant to be a limitation to patient rights. It's supposed to be explaining what the patient rights are. And when it does that, it's explaining these two independent exceptions. And in the second exception, the court is clearly excluded from that. And by using the word situation, again, I think that's a momentary situation that's justifying the need, and it's just referring to that under the general patient rights.
So under your interpretation, counsel, the facility would be able to administer some kind of medication to kind of prevent the ongoing emergent situation of I hate to use it, but dangerousness. She's striking people or hitting people. So they can medicate her, right? That's your argument. But they could only then sedate her, as I think Justice Ziegler was saying, because the administration of psychotropic drugs for treatment purposes, you can't give them and then take them away. That's harmful. You know, my background knowledge, hopefully that's expressed in the record somewhere. But if somebody needs a psychotropic drug for treatment purposes, this statute would not authorize the facility to provide that. They would be restricted to simply sedating the person to temporarily stop the dangerous situation that's created by the mental health issue.
Absolutely. And that's the beauty of the statute, is the legislator gave the facility time to sedate in the situation. And Chapter 51 then acts quickly, and it provides all those due process protections. I know my friend on the other side is saying this is a needs base, but needs is not defined. There's no dangerous definitions for needs. I mean, a schizophrenic person who's talking to butterflies flying around their head probably needs medication. So there's no limit on what this needs is. And it's important to note that that word needs is never mentioned in the court's determination. Under every statute, when the court is to make a determination, it is to determine based on the right to refuse. And that is the court's assessment under in that situation.
Is there any part of the Court of Appeals opinion that you disagree with?
Not that I disagree with, but I think it can be read too broadly. Because what the Court of Appeals was saying is that Chapter 5161 does not apply. But in context, I think the correct reading is 5161 does not apply for court orders under this dangerousness type situation. So to the extent that the Court of Appeals decision is read to read that 5161 never applies to these patients, I think would be wrong.
There was the amicus by the state public defender as well. Is there any disagreement that you have with the arguments laid out there, or are you fully in accord?
Without getting into a specific, I didn't see anything that I disagreed with, particularly in the amicus brief.
Okay.
Counsel, are you asking us to overrule any parts of Anthony DB?
Absolutely not. And that's one of the things that I wanted to get into, because I believe my friend on the other side is misreading Anthony DB. I want to read.
Oops, that was my fault. my papers.
Specifically, oh, sorry. Oh, I'm still on time. Okay.
Who's in control here?
that supposes you had control in the first.
Right. That assumes a fact, not an evidence.
Specifically, Anthony DB. If you look at paragraph 14, it block quotes 5161 with both unless provisions.
But then look at it right now while you're talking.
Paragraph 14.
Paragraph 14. Beginning with, although Anthony DB correctly points out that paragraph. Go ahead.
Yes, paragraph 14 I know has a block quote of 5161 with both unless provisions. If you look directly under that at paragraph 15, I wanted to read the quote, which I believe is the holding. Quote, section 5161 provides patients with the right to make informed decisions regarding medication, except in those circumstances where, following a constitutionally sufficient procedure, the patient is determined to be not competent to refuse medication. Under those circumstances, 5161.1G authorizes orders for involuntary administration of medication for individuals committed under Chapter 980, end quote. So my friend on the other side is saying that the court authorized these orders based on dangerousness, and I wholeheartedly disagree. The only time dangerousness was mentioned is one time in the fact statement by a claim that was made by the doctor, but that did not make its way into the court's holding, and the court never assessed that language. What the court was saying is 5161 under the first unless clause is the exception that gives the court authority. And that makes sense because that is where the hearing provisions are then discussed, because it says upon or after a hearing. And then if you go down, it talks about the report that may be admitted, doesn't have to be. That report needs to state the word needs and not competent to refuse. But that language never comes into the court's determination. It's just the doctor's report.
Can I ask you to address Ms. Jansen's argument regarding Sell? And as I understand her argument, a court should first address the dangerousness and then go to the Sell analysis. I got that wrong. Make sure you stand up and correct me, but I think that's correct. And I'm looking at Sell. And it does say a court need not consider whether allowed forced medication for that kind of purpose if forced medication is warranted for a different purpose, such as the purpose set out in Harper related to an individual's dangerousness. So I see where she gets that, and then that paragraph ends, and I'm at like the end of 181, beginning of 182. There are often strong reasons for a court to determine whether forced administration of drugs can be justified on those alternative grounds, one of those being dangerousness, before turning to the trial competence question.
Absolutely. Cell was a question about the constitutionality of what the government can do, not what the statutory authority allows the government can do. Specifically, it discusses Harper. And Harper specifically addressed a situation where there was statutory authority that allowed a physician to make this decision when there was a situation of dangerousness. And we agree that the legislator, under the proper procedures and due process, could enact provisions into 97114 or elsewhere that allows such a medication order to be issued, such as it did in Harper. Our legislator has not done that. And it's clear that our courts cannot issue medication orders without that authority. So Cell does discuss that, but it also discusses that courts or states usually address that in civil proceedings, civil matters. And that's exactly what Wisconsin does. That's why we have these extremely detailed provisions of 5120 discussing the mental health illness, the treatability, the dangerousness, all the rights that are associated, including a finding of clear and convincing on the dangerousness question. One of the issues here is what standard of proof would the court need to find this needs provision that my friend on the other side is claiming is dangerous. And we know from Addison that it has to be clear and convincing if it's going to be for getting you to a commitment. The individual under 5120 also has the right to request a closed hearing, request substitution of the judge, even a jury trial on the question of dangerousness. So those provisions our legislator has specifically enacted to give due process rights to individuals when that question is at issue. And we know that by enacting these stringent procedural requirements and narrow, precise standards, the state creates a liberty interest requiring strict adherence to ensure they are not arbitrarily abrogated. That's seen from Lessard v. Schmidt, Harper, and also Vitek v. Jones.
Are there any time limits on that? Because just thinking about this and the potential need to medicate when you start talking about a jury trial, and of course, we all believe in due process, it seems to me as though it could take an inordinate amount of time to get the person the medication that they need.
Absolutely. There are time limits in 5120 when, for example, an individual could be in a jail or a prison. They could be doing the exact same thing, harming workers, harming other inmates. In this, if you can imagine, their case is completed, so there's not a commitment currently. That same dangerous wouldn't allow the court to issue the order. They would have to go back, and I believe upon request, it's 14 days to have a jury trial. Again, the 5120 proceedings and time limits are meant to be narrow because we are trying to address a dangerous situation. So our legislator has limited the amount of time that can be spent. And in the interim, if somebody's attempting to bite off their tongue, or unless they're completely restrained, they're gouging their eyes, you can sedate them under the emergency exception. So all these things fit together in a perfectly set role under a statutory framework to cover every circumstance that can come up in the jail.
So if a person is, the lawyers come in and you can't ask them why, and you can't ask any as a judge, if someone says, I don't think this person's competent to proceed, the judge has to proceed and order evaluations and consider that. You can't really delve into that more, and I have no problem with that. But once that examination is ordered under 97114 sub 2, under 97114 sub 2F, it seems that the defendant has very limited ability to refuse medication and treatment if it's a situation where that treatment or medication will prevent harm to the defendant or others. Yeah. So if you're at the very early stages of determining in the first instance, competency to proceed, that defendant has no right to refuse medication or treatment. But then you're saying once they actually figure out that the person is not competent to proceed, then whether they're going to be harmful to themselves or others is irrelevant. You just have to let them hurt themselves or others unless you start over and start at chapter 51. So confined in a jail or wherever they're being evaluated, when they first come in, they can be administered medication without their consent or approval if they meet the dangerousness requirement, which I see dangerousness and physical harm to the person or others. That's very, very similar. In fact, almost the identical definition. But then after they actually are determined to be incompetent, that's when all of a sudden, whether they're harmful to themselves or others doesn't matter anymore. That's just got to start over in a chapter 51, unless the other cell findings are made.
I disagree, Justice Siegler, and because 971.14.2f does not mention the court issuing an order, it states the same general exception that's in 5161.
And we've talked about that before, but this isn't sedation. This is a treatment, medication and treatment. So this is the psychotropic medication or whatever it is that you were talking about before. And you were talking about psychotropic medication being forcefully administered without court approval in a competency setting. And then when Justice Bradley started asking you, it seemed like you shifted to say, no, you can only sedate. So I want to go back to that a little bit and find out where you are on that. Can the doctors without a court order just say, you know, you're dangerous to yourself or others and administer medication they think is appropriate without a court order in a competency proceeding?
So I'm a little confused by the reading of these two. I see 971.2f to be the exact same authority as 5161 in regards to this emergency exception.
I agree, and we're back to, shouldn't we be reading these all in conjunction with each other?
Yes. The only difference, or the similarity also between the two, is there's no court authority to issue an order. Again, that's talking about this emergency situation.
So are we back to the point that you don't need a court order? If someone's in a facility dangerous to themselves or others, the doctors can make that determination regardless of a court order for involuntary medication and administer psychotropic medication.
Absolutely. And again, it's during that situation, which is momentary. And it works with all the other statutes because it buys time then.
I mean, you might be right. I'm trying to figure it out. If that's the case, then involuntary medication orders and due process in that regard and competency proceedings are irrelevant because doctors can do it without a court order. And I think, unless it's changed since I was more involved in this stuff, psychotropic medication isn't just, you know, here you get some today, not tomorrow until you demonstrate you need it again. That would be part of a course of treatment because without that, the person's dangerous to themselves or others. And so doctors would just administer it regardless.
Absolutely. And those are great policy arguments for the court, the legislator to potentially ask for some type of court authority to issue an order.
So what your argument really is you don't need a court order for involuntary medication in a competency proceeding because it can be done anyway if needed because the person's dangerous to themselves or others in jail.
No, because when we talk about constitutional rights, whether it's the Fourth Amendment or liberty interests with medications, it's about reasonableness. Reasonably intruding upon the person's right to refuse medications under the emergency exception is momentary. And that's why it's talking about situational issues, both in 971.14.2f and in 5161. That's a momentary situation that allows, without the normal court process, to intrude upon that right momentarily, and then to pull that away once that moment expires.
So administer psychotropic medication in one instance, then don't do it the next day until they're dangerous again, then administer it again, then don't do it the next day, then administer it again every time they have a violent episode.
unless the state pursues the option they have by going under 5120 right away while that initial matter is being addressed, if there's a concern of ongoing dangerousness, that can be assuaged very quickly under the 5120 to allow that long-term treatment.
And can't they also do it under 97114 with the cell factors, which is what happened here. There was just an appeal that was being brought. A stay was ordered. Couldn't the argument in a stay be that we need to lift the stay and let this medication go in effect because of harms? Isn't that part of the weighing that the court does for the stay? So to say that the state has no other options here except 51, that's not really accurate.
It's not accurate, no, because they do have, it wouldn't have delayed the situation under the actual facts of this case.
Except even Cell says there are times these factors aren't relevant, like dangerousness. So Cell seems to leave this exclusion. And when I look at the court orders for involuntary medication or treatment that have been in place for a long time and that this judge actually used, I think it was changed after Cell to afford for the separated reasons for involuntary medication into sections, one for dangerousness and another needed to regain competency. And haven't these forms been in place for quite a while that judges are actually required to use? Not that the form can't be wrong, because it can be, but last modified in 19, and now here we are in this year trying to see if everybody's been doing it wrong for the last many years when groups of people get together, try to figure it out, and have come up with the notion that dangerousness is indeed a separate reason for involuntary medication.
Fitzgerald, paragraph 30, a judicially created form cannot save the Constitution statute, which is the same thing as it cannot provide the court this independent authority outside of the legislator. So I don't believe that this judicially created form does anything to this analysis.
But what I... But there's no judicial oversight of that.
Because of that, it's a momentary, and that allows that incursion into the liberty interest momentarily without the court being involved. And that's the give and take when we're talking about reasonableness and going into liberty interest, privacy interest, and things like that. And one of the other things I wanted to mention.
So why don't the cell factors apply at all when you're doing the initial evaluation?
The cell fact, I don't understand your question.
Under 2F. Where there's no court order, but there's just an evaluation happening and the person can be administered medication.
Well, I see my time is up. Could I answer?
Of course.
Thank you. It's because the 2F applies before the court's actually involved to make that determination. So again, that's why it's the medical professionals that's talking about. Once the report is issued that talks about not being competent to refuse, that's when the cell gets added on to that determination under Fitzgerald.
Yeah, except the court was involved. It ordered the examination. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you.
I want to start by saying I do disagree. There goes my pen. I do disagree with the reading of that second clause as only allowing for medication in a moment. The language of that second clause says necessary to prevent serious physical harm. And I read necessary as you can do medication for as long as it's necessary. So I don't agree that it would just be a momentary administration of antipsychotic medication. The plain language of the statute says necessary. So in my reading, as long as a person needs it to keep preventing the dangerousness situation, as long as you're a patient within the meaning of the statute.
And what do you do with the word situation? How do you read that into your analysis?
Can I look at the statute?
Sure. Because it says unless a situation exists. So the way you're reading it is taking that out, because if it was just necessary, you're just doing it.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, so what is situation? What about the unless a situation exists?
I think what they mean by situation is no time to wait. We have a true emergency. We've got to act right now. But I don't think that means then you just stop medicating.
Wouldn't that be a question for another day? of what the parameters of that would be once that was
sure.
given.
And I think it's important to just, I know I don't have a lot of time here, but to zoom out, because we've been spending a lot of time today on whether this statute authorizes a court to issue an involuntary medication order for dangerousness. And I think it's important to remember the Court of Appeals thought that it did. The Court of Appeals just said this statute doesn't apply to people committed under 97114. So the Court of Appeals did not question that if the statute applied to people committed under 97114, it would authorize involuntary medication orders for dangerousness. The Court of Appeals said this statute just doesn't apply to individuals. And it's really important to keep in mind that affirming that decision, if 5161 1G3 doesn't apply to individuals committed under 97114, that means the emergency part, that second clause that we've been talking about, doesn't apply. And what that means is Mendota, people at Mendota cannot act in a true emergency situation if that language does not apply to people committed. So they literally have to be in a situation where they're facing an emergent situation and ask, is this person here because of 980? Then we can act. If this person here because of 55, we can act. But if they're here because of 9714, we can't do anything. So I do think that aspect of the Court of Appeals opinion is particularly concerning.
I want to follow up just on Anthony DB and the logic of it, because I'm guessing I'm not, the Court of Appeals argues, and reading Anthony DB, you know, they run through the history, they say, okay, we can agree that you're a patient under 51, you know, 61, if you're committed under 971 or 980, right? And then it walks through the statutory history, at least some of the history, and then, you know, includes the Jones case, talks about new procedures were then enacted. And then its holding seems to be that the procedures in 5161, which include the one you're arguing for here, apply unless and until the legislature provides alternative provisions. And they had not done so for 980. But clearly, the only alternative provisions in its recent history that it was discussing were the ones in 971. And so the Court of Appeals looks at that logic, and it seems to say that there are, the legislature did provide alternative procedures, so 5161 does not apply. That's what Anthony DB says. So does your argument require us, can you address that? It seems that your argument actually is directly contrary to what Anthony DB says.
I think that language that you just said, or unless alternative provisions are provided, I really think that's just an imprecise articulation of the related statutes canon, which is that when we have closely related statutes, we are supposed to interpret them as one unless there is a conflict. And earlier in the opinion in Anthony DB, the court made very clear it understood how we treat closely related statutes. So I think all the court was really trying to say there is 5161 applies by its plain terms unless there is another medication provision that would conflict with it. That's how we do the related statutes canon.
Not always. I mean, it doesn't always have to conflict. I mean, you can read different statutes covering different situations. What it seems to be saying is not that they need to conflict, but that this is actually a new set of standards that apply to those under 97114. And therefore 5161 does not apply, which did not happen in the 980 context. So, I mean, what you're saying is an interesting reading of it, but that's just not what it says. And in context, the only alternative provisions that were enacted, the only ones are the ones listed in paragraph 18, which are what the legislature did after Jones.
May I respond, Chief Justice?
Yes.
Jones is a case that said broadly, broad strokes, an individual who is in a commitment cannot be involuntarily medicated without a finding of incompetency to refuse or unless you trigger the emergency clause. And in reaction to that, the legislature went and incorporated into various statutes language that said you have to first find someone incompetent to refuse medication. I think that is all the legislature was doing there when they incorporated that language in 97114. I don't think it was a statement that we don't want 97114 committing courts to have the to any longer have the authority to order involuntary medication for dangerousness under 5161 1G3. The legislature could have made clear in 97114, we don't want these committing courts to be able to medicate for dangerousness anymore. Or they could have altered 5161 1G3 in some way to make it not applicable to 97114, but it didn't.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We will be adjourned until we hear our next argument in about 15 minutes. Thank you, Councilor.